A retired judge in a candid and off-the-record moment once told me that he considered the justice system to be a class-based system and the police were the gatekeepers. Now, the fact that he probably doesn't say that at cocktail parties notwithstanding, I would have to say that that's quite an insightful observation, and it comes right from the horse's mouth, as it were. And I think it's really fundamentally true. The point, of course, is that they say that those who win get to write the history books. Well, in exactly the same way, those who rule in society get to define what justice is and get to define what crime is. And I think that's really fundamental to the point. In the 1830s in England, in southeastern England, there was an uprising of the agricultural workers responding to the starvation conditions that they lived in. It was known as the Swing Rebellion. And after it was over, after it had been put down, they established an extraordinary commission to go in and deal with the punishments. And when a lawyer for the defence put forward to the Lord Chief Justice, who was presiding, an outline of some of the starvation conditions and terrible grievances and situations that had prompted the rebellion, the judge replied by saying, "We have not come here to consider grievances, but to deliver justice." Now, a couple of days ago, I was down at plea court at the Old City Hall over a matter relating to our organisation, and a Vietnamese refugee was there who had been found guilty of stealing toothbrushes. And the situation hasn't quite reached the horrendous levels of the United States yet, but he did go down at the rate of 3 days per toothbrush. And an attempt was made to put forward the proposition that he had addiction problems and no counselling service available in his own language. And the whole thing was dismissed as utterly irrelevant. The only issue was, has he violated the criminal code? And if he has, he's going down. And it was appalling just to watch the treatment of person after person after person coming through the justice system. Now, there was a striking lack, and if you've ever been locked up in jail, you soon realise this. There's a striking lack of tax cheaters and industrial polluters and insider traders in those places. It's overwhelmingly the poor, and they're there for a reason. They're there because society wants to deliver a message to the poor about what norms are expected and what needs to be obeyed. Now, I think that we need to understand that that the law as an institution to uphold, serve and protect wealth, if you will, is very, very fundamental, and it goes right back to the earliest times. In the 1500s in Britain, in England specifically, you started to see the clearing of the land to make way for the new farming systems, and to create a new workforce. People who historically had their own plots of land and worked as peasants were thrown off the land and were expected to become waged workers. And so the law started to change, and the criminal justice system of the day started to change to uphold the needs of that situation. And you started to get legislation passed that demanded of people that they become waged workers. In fact, in 1537, during the reign of Henry VIII, they passed a piece of legislation saying that if someone was found to be what in those days they labelled a vagabond — today they usually use the term single employable, but it's the same sort of idea — if you were found to be a vagabond, i.e. you were somebody who didn't have a job, who was unemployed, the punishment that would be inflicted on you is, for the first offence, you would be tied to a cart tail and whipped. On the second occasion, the whipping would be repeated, but this time one of your ears would be cut off. And on the third occasion, you would be hung by a neck as an enemy of society. And this was all for not having a job. Now, I mean, there's a very, very clear example of ways in which law and repressive law is used to ensure that the needs of those who have the most privilege and the most power are enforced. Now, That's an extreme example that comes from an initial situation of needing to establish a certain order. Today, the expectation of going to work and working for somebody else has become much more fundamental, and I don't think they need to execute people for being unemployed, pillory them, deny them income and all and such like, but they don't need to resort to such extreme measures. But nonetheless, you really see a situation where that fundamental mechanism has remained at work. Now, sometimes they have chosen to take the regulation of people out of the immediate purview of the social justice system and use other forms of laws to control people. In the case of the vagabonds that plagued Tudor England, for example, they decided that the problem had become so pervasive, so massive, and indeed the rebelliousness of people who didn't take kindly to being treated in that way had become so enormous that different methods of regulation could be employed. Hence they brought in the poor laws, stating that the people that had no jobs would be confined in institutions called workhouses, where they would have to perform task labour in order to receive assistance. That incidentally is an example that's not so remote from the present day when you consider the workfare programs that the Ontario government is now introducing. But the fundamental point remains the same, that you have there a situation where the whole body of law is there to serve definite interests. And that, I think, has remained fundamentally true over the centuries. Sometimes it has... The criminal justice system and the law system and repression generally has been used against attempts by working people to organize socially and politically. In the first three decades of the present of the last century, the Canadian Armed Forces was called out against strikers on picket lines more times than it was employed against foreign enemies overseas. Injunctions and laws against trade unions and whatever were rampant and were employed in every industrialized society on a massive basis. And today, I would say there is a resurgence of the use of the justice system as a directly political weapon against people who organize. Outside of the realm of the overtly political use of the justice system and the criminal code, against people trying to organize, there's the more routine and everyday examples that we can give. And that is primarily directed against the what you might by and large term the acts of survival of poor people. The things that people do just to try and cope with their lives, to stay alive. And that involves not just the penalties in the form of incarceration, but it involves the use of various other measures to shut people down. For example, in the Dundas Sherburn area where we operate, there are a whole number of people who survive through participating in the sex trade. And the local residents' associations, the yuppie colonists who've come into the neighbourhoods and really bought cheap and intend to turn the neighbourhood into a community in their own image. They are now allowed to go when one of these women is, primarily women, is convicted. They are allowed to go and give victim impact statements and talk about the adverse effect of these women on their property values and quality of life. One particular woman there, Sharon Cook, was banned for a year from that community, notwithstanding the fact that that's where her apartment was and that she would be rendered homeless by being banned. That was after serving a 90-day jail sentence. Moreover, she went back to the location one day prior to the expiry of the ban to try and get some food from a drop-in center, was identified by a police officer, did another 90 days in jail, and was this time banned from the community for another 2 years. So it isn't just the barbarity and the enormity of what is happening, it's how it is being used to serve a set of particular interests, to maintain the king's peace in the interest of the people who really profit from it. And I might also add that the concept of criminality as I showed, I think, with the initial examples of the establishment of a capitalist system itself, the concept of criminality changes with the needs of the situation. And one of the key examples I could give of that is the so-called Safe Streets Act that has been passed by the Conservative government. This is the law that makes it illegal to squeegee, and it is the law that makes it effectively illegal to panhandle, and provides very severe penalties for doing these things. When the Attorney General of Ontario, James Flaherty, first introduced this bill at this ridiculous charade of a press conference where a platoon of police marched out of the press conference to start implementing the act. When Flaherty was asked if this law in fact discriminated against the poor, perhaps remembering the words of Anatole France, he said, no, not at all. This law applies to everybody. It doesn't just apply to people who are poor. And so, of course, if Conrad Black decides to panhandle next to a subway stop, he's going to be in very severe trouble. But obviously, the point is, however, that a number of years ago, they didn't need legislation specifically banning panhandlers. The enthusiastic behavior of police forces was enough to deal with the situation. But precisely because they have decided to take all the emphasis out of social provision and use the policeman's billy club as the alternative method of social regulation, they now need a battery of legislation, in fact a redefinition of crime that suits their purposes. If they're going to abandon people to mass destitution, where people will attempt to congregate in city centres to try to survive, then quite obviously what they need to do is to find ways to get rid of those people, to remove them from sight. Locking them up is one solution, driving them away is another solution. But that's precisely how law is being defined. And they're very, very clear about it. There's a staff sergeant at the 52 Division, a charming fellow by the name of Naismith. He attended one of our events and told me, he said, the most important function that I have as a police officer is to ensure that the business climate in the downtown of Toronto is preserved by keeping vagrants out of the city centre. Now, I don't quite know what section of the criminal code he was referring to when he said that, but he was very clear about what he needed to be doing. And I just conclude with a couple of points. I think that the direction that is being pursued here in Canada, as in many, many areas, is falling in line with the more extreme and advanced situation in the United States. The super jails, the changes to legislation, all the things that are going to push up the rates of incarceration and increasingly, in effect, make it illegal to be poor. They basically, I think, have decided that from now on, the relative compromise that existed during the post-war years is coming to an end. That there isn't going to be the social programs, the housing, the things that previously people were granted, as inadequate as these things were, that they are systematically going to be taken away. And that their solution is to alternatively regulate people through the use of, by criminalizing them. It's going to be a massive aspect of the political agenda that we're going to be confronting in the period ahead. And I think the whole question of challenging that barbarity is going to be enormously important. People like Harris and his agenda of common sense is now, of course, going national, are committed to the common sense proposition that if people are poor, people are bad, and bad people need to be locked up for extremely long periods of time. So I think an agenda of response to the whole inhumanity of the attack that's going on has to pay great attention to the criminal justice system, to the prison institutions that go with it, and I think we need to say that those kinds of repressive relics of barbarism are what needed to be challenged and need to be fundamentally altered.